session number 30304.
Said we're in at reel 10. Were you ever given ground duties as well to do at all while you were there?
Well, the ground duties which come first in my mind, of course, at Little Risington, was having to crank start the Ansons at Kidlington and push them about and that kind of thing and do the groundwork. I've forgotten what the question is now.
Did you do ground duties?
Ground duties, yes. We were... if by ground duties you mean such things as orderly sergeant, or... that's about all that would be possible, I think. And of course one had to do that later on, when in a squadron. We didn't, quite frankly, we didn't have time to do anything other than learn about flying and actually doing it. We were, at this time, of course, training whilst France fell. When we started on the course, and I think I speak for all of us on the course, we regarded it as great fun, even cranking engines. And of course we had our fun moments both travelling between Risington and Kidlington, and also in the mess from time to time. But it really was quite high-pressure stuff, because by the time we got our wings and we could fly, actually be part of the RAF as a pilot, it was becoming increasingly obvious that things were not looking very good. And so I think we were much more serious by the end of the course than we were at the beginning. And quite a lot of the course went through their conversion to squadron aircraft, particularly the single engine types, and into squadrons during the Battle of Britain. We were blessed in the sense that we didn't have to do any administration duties.
One other thing that occurs to me at this time, at this stage, had you done any night landings at all during
the training? Yes, they were similar, of course, to the daytime. At that time, the RAF was still using the gooseneck flares, which used paraffin or that kind of petroleum product. And all they were, actually, was sort of looked like sacking wound pushed down a spout. They were called gooseneck because that was the shape of the funnel from the can to where the rag, to give it as general a name as possible, came out of the end, and it was actually lit, I won't say by a match, but by another length of flame, and it took quite a time to get them all out and in position and so on. And of course that was the only means of giving you the direction for takeoff and landing available at the time. They would only be down the left hand side, because of course in aircraft, even all those that I've seen, foreign or not, the pilot was in the left-hand seat, so the flares would be spaced at about every, and I'm sure lots of ground crew will contradict this, because I never measured it, but from the imagined length as you go past it when you start your takeoff run, I would say there would be about 20 yards apart, something like that. So on a 500 yard runway, you'd have about 10 flares. Well, perhaps it doesn't work out. I don't know, but that. There was also a powerful spot floodlight shining from the touchdown side end of the runway. Not on the runway, of course, it would be some distance back and on the opposite side to the flares. We didn't even have that to start with, but that would be commonplace by the time we'd done two or three night exercises. And the formula, of course, was the same. Take off up to 500 feet, turn left, another 500 feet, turn left. Then you're on the downwind leg. And the flares had one great advantage over, like every improvement, there is, to some extent, a loss. And the loss was that with a flare, because it was burning some stinking petroleum product, there was a lot of smoke. And so, as you were coming in on the approach, and even sometimes on the downwind leg, you got a jolly good idea of what the wind was doing, because the smoke was telling you. Now, and of course, with some kind of electrical illumination, that wasn't the case.
I take it as well that you must have done some instrument training as well.
Well, we did that, of course, all the way through, from elementary flying training at Fair Oaks, in the Link Trainer, which was a box with a hood, just about as roomy as most cockpits in aircraft. And to give you a sense of simulation, it seems incredible, but if you imagine a box which can move around on a sort of pivot, this box had little wings on it, attached to it. I don't know whether that was to remind you as you got into the box that you were actually going to fly an aircraft or something. It was linked up, I suppose that's right, it's called the Link Trainer. I don't know whether that was the manufacturer's name again or not, but it was linked to a table at which the instructor would be seated, and he had a sort of crab type of machine which responded to the movements that you were able to make inside the box, so that you could be told to steer a course, or you could be told to turn, and this would be, the table was quite, well, probably about a yard or more circular in diameter, a yard in diameter, something like that. He could either give you an exercise on a blank chart or paper or whatever it was, or he could have determined the exercise he wanted you to do. So he may have got lines on his paper from A to B to C to D and so on, going all the way around, and you He could make an allowance for all the time it took to make a turn and so on. The only difference, of course, was that altitude had to be estimated, or it was in the imagination, let's say, because you couldn't get off the ground in this box. So that whichever way it was done, you were being checked for accuracy in your flying. You could go into a spin in them, and you could stall. You'd have to make the necessary correction. So it wasn't always a matter of putting something on paper. Obviously you can't record a spin on a paper, on a chart. They were very, very good for instrument flying, and of course that has led to the wonderful simulators that are in use today. It's mostly vacuum operated, I think. You used to hear a sort of bellows effect, I suppose, that because there was a sort of concertina bottom to it, so that, you know, I suppose it was to keep the dust out or something.
Did you do any instrument flying in aircraft as well at that stage?
Instrument flying? Oh, yes. Yeah.
What form did that take to do in an aircraft?
Well, just a simple, straightforward, mainly to check that you could maintain the attitude of the aircraft that was required on instruments, equally well as to using the horizon or externally, taking external checks. But that would be part of many of I don't actually recall an exercise specifically for instrument flying. It would be included in some of the other work that you would be doing with the instructor, largely at his... I would think that the instructor had carte blanche in the sense that if he found that you weren't very good on instruments, and obviously it was up to his it was his job to see that you improved, and so you may have more instrument flying in the air than you thought was necessary, but it certainly wasn't forgotten. I must say I felt very confident on instruments, because I think I had a good instructor.
Initially, is it easy though to trust just your instruments, or does your body tell you that you might be doing something else?
Well, you soon have to. Your body obviously let's just take doing a circuit at night, particularly. If you don't trust your instruments, then you might just as well not bother, because it's surprising how quickly the runway disappears, and then you've just got, there's nothing in front, blackness. I think that in itself makes a pilot or any person sort of look at what is important. There's nothing else, don't forget, there's nothing else to look at. So you might as well look at your instrument, sort of thing. And if you've said goodbye to the runway at night and you haven't got onto your instruments before you're less than 100 feet, then you're going to feel a little lonely and wondering what's going to happen next. It just becomes second nature. You really The only thing with it, the flares, the runway lights, whatever they are there for, is to give you a guide. You're going off into the dark, and so instruments, well, they're just the wonderful things when you're going around.
So is that important instilling into you at that stage, the importance of trusting your instruments?
Oh, absolutely, yes. But of course, what goes with that is care. That you've got the right settings, that you're on zero. I mean, if you're doing a circuit and you just want to go round, you want your altimeter to be as accurate as possible. So it's no use starting to leaving the runway with it not accurately set at whatever pressure is appropriate. And normally, just for circus and bumps, you would have it at zero, of course. But if you're taking off from an aerodrome such as Little Rissington, which was 800 and something feet above sea level, and you were flying to a different aerodrome, and you knew the setting of, or you'd ask for before you got there, when you were able to. I mean, couldn't do that in the Tiger Moth, but you can in an Anson, or any other aircraft more modern than an Anson. But if you set your altimeter at zero when you are Little Rissington, you're already 800 feet above sea level, and that would mean that it wouldn't be set correctly by the time you got to this aerodrome to which you were flying, if it was at a lower altitude than Little Rissington. So that kind of thing always has to be borne in mind. That just for circuits and bumps, you're coming back to the same place, and within a very short period of time, you hope, you would set it to zero, because that's the easiest checkpoint.
Can I ask you at this time, within your training, what flying clothing you were wearing?
Flying clothing? In the Anson. It wasn't flying clothing. Well, yes, boots. The old-fashioned boots. I say old-fashioned because we were rather proud wearers of the original type of flying boot, which was a Wellington-type boot. They were beautiful things. Fur-lined leather. Like a Wellington boot, a rubber Wellington boot, is today. But of course, they were a problem if misfortune struck, in two respects. You could hardly get your trousers over the boots, outside the boot, I mean, so that if you were shot down, it was a giveaway. Whatever else you could do, get rid of your uniform and so on. If you put your trousers over your boots thinking that the rest of what anyone could see resembled a foot, or the bottom part may resemble a foot, but then you've got some great big thing in your leg. The other thing was, of course, if you came down in the drink, in the sea, then they were difficult, very difficult to get off. And somebody had the bright idea, of course, of what later became the standard pattern of a zip and a top to the... it was in two parts together, shoe part, and the legging part. And you normally carried some implement with you, such as a knife, where you could quite easily cut off the upper part, the legging, from the shoe, so that they did actually look like shoes and you didn't have this bulge in your leg.
But were you, the rest of you, would you just be wearing just your uniform?
Yeah.
As such?
And the usual number two, I think it was called, you know, the typical...
the service dress type.
Sometimes, yes, sometimes you'd wear number one uniform, it didn't matter. But then, of course, at that time, we didn't have them. We didn't have number one. No, we didn't have... Oh, that's right, yes, we didn't have... We didn't have the number two type, you know, just the sort of... What am I, what?
The battle dress blouse.
Battle dress blouse, that's right, yeah. We didn't have those, no. No, I think we got them probably during the second part of the course. We just had one uniform. That took a long time to get, of course, since we recorded. Anyway, that was the situation. That's uniform.
And could I just ask about your logbook? Because that would have been issued to you when you started flying.
Well, that was issued pre-war, of course.
What do you have to record in your logbook?
Well, it's just a matter of flying time. There were various columns. The columns for single engine, columns for double multi-engine, columns for first pilot or second pilot, or of course what other designations, in time, observers and navigators and the crew members had their own smaller, narrower logbooks. And then flying hours, day, hours and minutes, flying hours, night, and then a space for remarks. For instance, missed target or bad landing, that sort of thing. It's rather funny that when I went to the archives at Kew to look through the operational record books, I had quite a time to work out how it was that I had more flying hours on ops than was shown in the operational record book. And it took me some time to realise that on my first tour with 220 Squadron, this was before navigators were insufficient numbers for to do away with a second pilot, and we had been taught to be able to navigate as well as pilot the aircraft. It suddenly dawned on me that the more experienced pilot would be shown as the captain, and the rest of the crew would be down as and crew. I looked through these records and I thought, good God, far more flying than that. Until I started linking the name of the pilot with the blokes that I knew I had flown with. And it wasn't until I became one of the elder brethren, as it were, and I was a captain, that I saw my name in the operational record book. Now, what was the... Where were we?
Well, I was just wondering as well, was there any accidents on the course?
Accidents? Oh, yes. Well, I was responsible for two of them. At Little Rissington.
Little Rissington, yeah.
No. Not to my knowledge. I don't know about the Harvard people. I think they had one or two. I suppose they're relatively small aircraft and quickly swept away off the...
And what was the kind of failure rate amongst your peers? Was there a number of people who were not getting through this second stage at all?
No. They all got through as far as I remember.
How did you feel, obviously, as the course is coming to an end? Did you feel a growing confidence as a pilot in your capabilities?
It's a rather silly reason. To think, as I have done recently, how confident we were. But when you get amongst a group of like-minded chaps and begin to realise you're up against it, it's no use not being confident. There are two kinds of confidence. There is confidence that you want to show because it helps other people to join you in the mission, whatever it is. And then there's the other kind of confidence which you've got to have in yourself, which you can only get through concentration, determination, taking things in your stride. I mean, you know, you may disagree with one or two of the things that the instructor did or showed you, or you felt that he wasn't as good as you'd like him to be. I didn't come across that very, very often, but you've got to have the will to carry out whatever you were asked to do. And most people were very understanding about that. It was the people who knew least about real leadership and what it's like to, you know, those sitting back in some office somewhere. I don't want to go into that.
Was there a final examination that you would take
on
completing the course?
I don't remember much about it, but there was some kind of a final check when we were all in the usual way, you know, at our little tables in some large room somewhere. I think there were one or two who struggled, but they were okay. It's no problem.